Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is January 11th, 2023. First item on the calendar for argument is Doe 598 versus Special School District Number 6. Council, I know you are familiar with our proceedings and procedures. I'll remind you that you should all both identify yourself when you begin your argument. You'll each have 15 minutes to present the argument with 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'm glad to see you made it through the snow, and I recall the last time I was in court, you were in, and we were in a snowstorm again. So welcome to winter in Minnesota, I guess. With that, Council for Appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael Bryant representing Doe 598. And yeah, I did bring the snow last time, so I apologize for doing that again. I'm glad, like I said before, I'm happy to be here back here in person. It's nice to not be doing this by Zoom and actually being here. I spent a lot of time last night thinking about this case and what I thought I thought were the keys as far as it goes. And I think it's figuring out what is enough red flags for a court to allow the case to go ahead. And I know from the lower court's argument that I believe the district court judge struggled with the idea of what would it take? Is there some bright line number that we know if there's 10 red flags or 20 red flags, does that make a difference? I look at it that one red flag is enough to be able to do something. Maybe it's not fair, maybe you need more than that, but one red flag's enough. We identified in this case at least 12 to 15 different red flags, some bigger than others, but points where the school should have at least potentially been on notice. They should have had some concern about what's going on. Now, we know from the beginning that this person, Babbitt, was a perp. I mean, there's no question about it. There's no question that he abused children there. The question is what did the school know? When did they know it? The respondent wants to push it into that the school almost had to require it or had to be part of it for them to somehow be responsible. And I'd submit that doesn't need to be at that point. They need to know enough or be able to see enough to be able to ask questions.
You go ahead.
Mr. Bryant, you're talking about, when we talk about red flags, it seems to me to go more toward the foreseeability issue, and I'm struggling, I must say, initially with the immunity issue.
Okay.
So how do we assess what's in the scope of, was in the scope of Babbitt's employment when he was overseeing, you know, any sort of guest or volunteer in the classroom? You know, I mean, this is summary judgment, so, I mean, we need something to say, okay, what did that include? So what do we have there? I mean, I know, so he signed in, so the school knew he was there. And I must say, I am troubled. Well, I'm troubled by so many things in this case. Mm-hmm. But I, just from a legal perspective, troubled by the fact that he was given, or, you know, that's what the complaint says, access to a porn website in the classroom shortly before the assaults. But he wasn't a student there, so that gets to my, is there some showing that that was in the scope of the employment?
Well, he was there to volunteer. He wasn't there as just stopping by as a friend. Babbitt was there as his teacher, and he was bringing in volunteers.
But Babbitt wasn't his teacher then. I mean, do you have any sort of job description, any policy of the districts talking about just a responsibility for overseeing what happens in the classroom? Anything that would help us?
With volunteers?
For whether it's volunteers or guests or something that might apply to this situation. Like I said, I'm kind of going back to that. Is it within the scope, arguably, of his employment? So that we don't have immunity bar on this.
Yeah, I would look at it in two ways, okay? The grooming that took place with this individual, with my client, with Doe 598, took place in a lot of different ways, not just the volunteer way. So in part, I don't know that we're just limited to the grooming that took place there or the action that took place there. So I would submit it's bigger than that. But if we just look to that individual piece, I believe that the evidence shows that, or I would submit that the evidence shows that the only reason why Doe was there was as a volunteer for the action for the teacher, for the school. So there is enough there in the nexus between the reason why they wanted him to come in the front door so they knew, even though Babbitt would let him in the back door. The reason why they needed to check in so they knew who was going around the school to protect other kids and also to protect their safety too. And third, the use of other students from this other school, that was a common activity for those volunteers. So I do believe that there's enough of a connection there to show that they're just somebody other than just a random person walking around the school, if that answers your question. And maybe not.
I'm still struggling with that, but go ahead.
Sure. So I believe that that gives us enough of a connection in that the school actually had policies with the volunteers. I mean, they had policies in checking in. They had policies about them coming the back door. One of the concerns that we pointed out was that the principal knew that Babbitt was giving these kids rides that were volunteers. So it wasn't just, it doesn't matter. He was giving these kids rides, and that was something against the policy, and she actually was aware of that.
And how many times did that occur? I'm struggling with understanding what the red flags that should have been observed and the red flags that were observed.
Okay. As far as the number of times each of them existed or happened?
Well, let's start first with this knowledge of the leaving the door open, or the knowledge of giving Doe a ride home.
Okay.
What's the evidence?
She indicated that she was aware of it, that she knew it happened. I think her indication was only once that she was aware of it, but it's a violation of the policy, and that should be of a concern.
But what kind of a concern? I mean, where's the connection that the act of driving a child home or driving a minor home is a red flag such that the district would be on notice of a potential sexual assault situation?
Well, there's two parts to that. Is one, we have the that it's against the policy, and she recognizes it against the
there
policy.
There are lots of things that are against policies, right? I mean, not every single policy violation amounts to this could be a potential sexual assault situation.
I would agree, but the idea of taking kids off campus on your own when you're an adult and they're a minor goes closer to that. Now,
and what's the evidence? So this is sort of I'm getting to the point of, we don't have an expert report. We don't have a 5606 affidavit saying I need more time to produce an expert report. So what's the record evidence that gets us over that hump, that this red flag is really a red flag that this terrible thing is about to happen or could potentially happen?
Well, we have the the evidence that we provided from the two experts, Arundhati, who was sick, his part, and then Cunnell, who talked about the foreseeability. So we had that from all the other cases that were involved in this. So we had more than just nothing as far as that goes. But we have her admitting that it's a risk and it's violating the policy. And there's a reason for that policy, to protect children. That's what it's about. So I would submit that that's enough to get us to a jury and a jury to look at it. Beyond that, the second part of that, and it's a good question, is we're also stuck a little bit in that there was no training that was going on during that time period, because some of it, we were behind as far as it goes. But looking back, it definitely was a dangerous circumstance. And that's something I would submit a jury should be able to weigh. A jury should be able to hear testimony that says, we didn't do the same training that we did then. So maybe it was a different time period. But a jury should make that decision, not a court as far as the legal matter. That's a fact issue. No, I think, did you have a question?
Well, I was going to ask a question, I guess getting back to the vicarious liability and the question of immunity. How, as I read our court's decision in Doe versus Columbia Heights,
sure,
it really turned on the undisputed evidence in that case that the coach was, his texting and his sexual contact with the student were for his own purposes, not the school's. How is that any different here? Are you contending there was evidence that the teacher here was grooming and committing sexual assault on behalf of the school?
He was doing it in his capacity, in his employment capacity.
Well, but that's the same as in Doe. I mean, and our court looked beyond the fact that, yes, it happened within at the school, within school hours, but that wasn't the determinative fact in Doe. I mean, the determinative fact was, did he do it for himself or on behalf of the school? Why isn't that same analysis applicable here?
We spent time in the brief talking about the distinction between the two cases, that it involves. I mean, he took advantage of the grooming to do this someplace else, and our argument is that they should have recognized or stopped the grooming is what is that part of it. So what happened in that the Doe 175 case was actions that took place actually at the school. And the plaintiff, I think, got put in a bad position of trying to prove that the school somehow was involved or was responsible for it actually taking place at the school. Argument's a little bit different than that, in that ours is based upon the grooming that he took place in his capacity as a teacher. He did things where the coach did things that were completely outside of being a coach. It's not part of being a coach. He's not doing things as a coach.
Well, but he supervised the weight room, and students come and go from the weight room, so, right?
He was there. He was allowed on camp. I would agree with that. But here we've got the teacher who's taken the authority of having the hugs in the classroom, having the people come into the classroom. He's got different authorities and different actions that all go into the grooming part of it that's different. He has a different involvement that's completely done only through his authority as a teacher.
And then,
but Mr. Bryant, shouldn't it give us pause that this grooming that took place as a teacher is removed by a number of years from when the sexual assault took place, as opposed to what happened in the Doe 175 case, where it was much more, it was much closer in time, which I guess is why I was going to the, what happened when he was, the student was a volunteer. Mm-hmm. So help me with that if you can.
Should give you pause because of...
Because of the years.
You're right, right.
I mean, when we're looking at, is this within the scope of his employment, and we're looking at those numbers of years between between when he was had him as a student as opposed to as a volunteer.
Well, I would say no, because the grooming that actually takes place is taking place that it leads to it. I mean, that there wasn't earlier action, or there wasn't more people that were groomed and more people this happened to, is a good thing as far as that goes. But the reality is, no, I don't think that the distance changes it, because it's actions a school could have done to stop this from the very beginning and save all these kids. I think the more time that goes by and the more it continues, there's more of an opportunity, because these are the same kids being groomed from the beginning that eventually happens, that there's a longer possibility and there's a longer opening. So when the principal sees them coming off campus, when they're coming back on campus and they're kids from before that were being hugged before, that all gives us more opportunities to look at it and more places the school should have done something about this to stop it. Or at least there's enough evidence there that a jury should hear that and make the determinations on it. If the jury decides, no, these are too distant, then that's a jury decision. But I'd submit that the red flags put us in a position to go ahead, so a jury should be able to hear it.
Can I ask you about the red flags?
Great question, though.
You say in your brief, I guess I'm looking specifically on pages 6 and 7. And
of my brief?
You're talking about Ms. Garling Squires, and there's a number of statements about how the teacher's conduct violated school policies, et cetera, that are sort of prefaced with the statement, Ms. Garling Squires indicated that had she known of XYZ. Would you agree with me that it's not a red flag if they don't know about it, and there's no reason they would have known about it?
Well, the second part is interesting, is there's no reason they would have known about it. It's always a red flag. Okay, whether or not they know about it, the question is, why didn't they know about it? Part of it was the training was really poor back earlier and they weren't getting trained the way they should have gotten trained is part of it. Second part is, I don't think they were looking well enough at it, because you had actually...
How would they have known, for example, that the teacher let Doe 598 and a handful of other students, and one in particular, stay in at recess or have different lunches or provide them with Jimmy John sandwiches? How did the school know about any of that?
By keeping
grooming behavior.
By keeping their eyes open and seeing it, because it did happen. It wasn't hidden in the sense that it was, you know, completely impossible to see. They should have known about the lack of a chaperone on the trip. They should have known about him staying in the same room with the kid. There's all
but
these.
But there was chaperone. Wasn't there an adult in every room with the kids on the field trip? Parents and
staff? He actually
staff?
Chose to be in the same room with the client, with my
client. Oh, with the hand, with a number of kids, right? There were four
right.
or five?
But that was against the policy for him to do what he did.
To select the group of
kids. To select the group of kids that he's with. And that's the kid he brings back as a volunteer. It's all these connections with the kid that if someone's looking and watching, there's enough red flags there that it should be seen. Because it's clearly a red flag. All of these things are red flags.
Okay, and I'm sorry, your time
has
exceeded, and you answered my question. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Vieira, and I represent the respondent, South St. Paul Public Schools. It's reasonable to look at this case and be appalled that a teacher and his spouse sexually abused one of the teacher's former students. And the district doesn't dispute that. But this lawsuit isn't about the underlying horrific acts. It's about whether the teacher's employer is liable for sexual assaults when it's undisputed that the district did not know about them. They took place off of school property and outside of school hours. And the answer, based on clear precedent from this court, is no. I want to first start by talking about the record, because appellant's counsel gave you a lot of information about what he says the principal said in her deposition, what she said about policy violations. The principal's deposition is not in this record. It's very clear, according to Rule 110.01, that the record before this court are the documents that were submitted before the district court. In this case, the female principal to which he's referring, her deposition took place after the summary judgment motion was argued. So it was not before the district court judge when he made that decision. It's also not anywhere in the record. If you look for it, you won't find it. There was no motion to supplement the record. There was no motion before the district court to delay the summary judgment motion to continue discovery. So all of the claims about policy violations or what that principal said, I encourage the court to ask for the record citation because they're not there. Additionally, with some of the facts that the court was discussing, I do want to give you some record sites to just address them. The first is that with respect to the pornographic password, the student was not given that at school. In his deposition, which is index number 64, exhibit 10, he testifies that he knows the date he was given that password. And when we compare that to the list of dates that he signed in when he attended school, because he always signed in, that date isn't on the list. So the appellant admits that he did not receive that at school, even though that was an allegation in this case.
Well, but this was after he'd been absent from, he was no longer a student of the teacher and was back at the teacher's behest to serve in a volunteer position, correct?
That's correct.
So why does it matter whether, I mean, would you agree with me that the connection at the teacher's behest occurred and then the password was provided as part of this, I guess, renewal of the relationship between the two?
I think it was provided as part of an ongoing personal relationship between the two of them. We know that the student had no contact with the teacher between the time he finished sixth grade in 2012. Then there was a minimal contact between the teacher and the the appellant's parent in 2014 when Babbitt reached out because the appellant had come out as gay. And then in 2015-2016, when this relationship started up again, it was appellant's mother that gave Mr. Babbitt his email address to contact him about volunteering. So, and that all took place because appellant's mother was friends with Mr. Babbitt. So those weren't that wasn't a relationship that the school set up or encouraged. That was an outside relationship that Babbitt pursued independent of what his job was as an employee of the school. And I think that that...
Do you agree, counsel, that the grooming behavior, and I think we all have a sense of what that is, and it's well recognized as part of sexual abuse. Do you agree that that this grooming behavior, or at least some of it, occurred while Doe 598 was a student in the teacher's classroom and within the time and space limits of the teacher's employment?
I do, but I don't think that's sufficient to hold the district liable for the later sexual conduct for a couple reasons. The first is that appellant admits that the grooming behavior inherently overlaps with teaching duties. So things like building a relationship with a student is something that the school wants its teachers to do. And although in retrospect, certainly now we can look back and see that that's a concern, at the time, the district wouldn't have known, wouldn't have been able to predict that that was something other than normal relationship building with students. And although I don't believe that appellant's expert reports should be considered because none of them are sworn testimony or signed by the expert, what is included in one of those summaries is that grooming behaviors are often hard to tell in the initial stages until you're looking back after the fact. So I don't think the school was on notice in 2012 that even if it had known that the student was receiving special attention, which it didn't, that the school would have then been on notice that that was grooming behaviors. But the second reason that I don't think that that's relevant to the outcome here is that the underlying tort for which the appellant seeks to hold the school vicariously responsible is the tort of sexual assault, not the tort of grooming. And it doesn't appear that any court in Minnesota has had an opportunity to consider whether grooming is either a separate tort or part of the tort of sexual abuse. But we did a nationwide research, and what we found were those three cases from Missouri that are cited in our brief, and all of them held that grooming is a separable act from the act of sexual assault. So even if some of the grooming took place at the school, and even if the school was aware of it, which there's no evidence that it was, the fact that the actual sexual assaults took place off of school property at a Minneapolis hotel and at a private family cabin on a weekend and over the summer, which is clearly outside the time that teachers are expected to perform their duties, means that it didn't fall within the scope of his employment for under the Fahrendorf standard. But I do want to pivot back to the statutory immunity standard. I know Judge Jessen had asked, how do we determine the scope of duty when he's supervising these volunteers? And in Doe 598, adapting the definition from Minnesota Statute 3.732, subdivision 1, paren 3, the court held that when an employee is acting within the scope of their duties, it's when they're acting on behalf of the employer in the performance of duties or tasks lawfully assigned by competent authority. And there is no question here that when Babbitt was sexually assaulting an appellant, he was not performing duties or tasks lawfully assigned by the district.
Can I just stop you? Because when I'm right there, when I was looking at your brief and dealing with the Columbia Heights case, your reading seemed to say, look, as long as there is some policy out there saying don't sexually assault people, right, that's don't do it, that the governmental entity should be immune from vicarious liability for this type of conduct. I mean, that's a pretty extreme statement. Is that truly the district's position?
So that's not the district's position. I think there certainly could be fact scenarios that in which someone sexually assaults someone as under the scope of their job duties, but I don't think that's what happened here. The other thing to keep in mind is that the scope of...
So if the sexual assault, let's say, had happened, when Babbitt was the teacher, so when there was clearly a current student, I mean, would you agree that that could, depending on the facts, at least survive summary judgment? on the immunity charge.
I think with the right fact scenario there, a active sexual assault while a person is a teacher, while the victim is a student, could at least survive summary judgment. But the underlying premise of that...
But even where there's a policy that says it's against, you know, don't do this. It's not in your job duties.
Well, I think that there could be a circumstance where someone is directed to do something against a policy. So I'm not sure the policy would trump the lawfully assigned by competent authority. But the underlying assumption there is that municipalities should be liable for sexual assaults of their employees. And because liability for municipalities is something that's defined by statute, because it defies the common law expectation of sovereign immunity, the legislature does have the right to limit claims against municipalities.
But aren't we supposed to look at those exceptions narrowly and construe them narrowly?
I think they are construed narrowly, but this case is on all fours with the way that exception was applied in the Columbia Heights case. So on these facts, I think it's clear that the that statutory exception would apply. I want to turn briefly to the general negligence claims. It's on the statutory immunity question, it's also clear to me that the statutory immunity would trump any Fahrendorf-Marsden line of respondeat superior if the legislature has defined specific vicarious liability for these types of employers. But with respect to the general negligence and the question of foreseeability, the issue there is whether the specific act was reasonably likely to foresee and that a reasonable school district would have taken steps to avoid that conduct. But we also have that KL v. Riverside case where the court said that in the absence of prior similar incidents, sexual abuse will rarely be deemed foreseeable. And on this record, there is no evidence of prior sexual abuse. This is where we get into the red flags theory. But the red flags that the appellant has actually identified here, none of them were both sexual and known to the district. The appellant.
But what would be the purpose of a policy not permitting a teacher to, for example, select students to room with in an off campus event? I mean, what would that be addressed to other than the possibility of sexual abuse?
So that's not a policy that exists or is in this record. What is in the deposition transcript of the principal that's, again, not before this court, is that she expected teachers to take special care and decide whether some students needed to be with a teacher rather than a parent, because some students might be particularly vulnerable to bullying or incidents from peers. They might also be prone to homesickness and need the additional support of a licensed person rather than a parent who's sort of tagging along to chaperone for the trip. But you won't find that policy in this record. And the foreseeability question here, the red flags that have been identified, many of them come after the conduct was reported to the police. So there's no dispute. The record is very clear that the first time the district was on notice that Babbitt had sexually assaulted former students was when this appellant went to the police in August of 2016. He admits he did not report any of the suspicious conduct to the district. He didn't report it to anyone except maybe a friend. So to hold that the district should have known about this private relationship that was ongoing between a teacher and a former student, when the student admits he didn't tell the district, the student's mother admits he didn't tell the district, is asking the district to extend its supervision into teachers' personal lives, which clearly isn't the standard that a reasonable school district would follow, and there's certainly no expert opinion in this record that says that it is. So these red flags are not things that should have put the district on notice of potential sexual assault. The other two that plaintiff relies on are things like the fact that Babbitt drove appellant home. So again, there's nothing in this record that says that the principal knew about that. In fact, what the hearsay in the brief says is if she had known about it, she would have done something. But further, the appellant admits that he doesn't think anybody saw them in the parking lot. Appellant also doesn't say anything sexual happened during that car ride. So to hold that the district should have been monitoring its parking lot to make sure teachers weren't violating its expectation that they not drive students home, when that policy wouldn't even have applied here because he wasn't a student at the time, it extends liability to making schools responsible for some sort of, you know, continuous surveillance of teacher activities outside of the normal school day. And I think the issue of whether, of what a school district's obligations are to students versus non-students is just one more quick point I want to make. The district's expert affidavit explained that although it was the norm at the time to have policies about interactions with students, he was not aware of any school districts that had policies addressing conduct with former students. So to find that the district somehow had a duty to this former student when it was purely, definitely not the norm for schools to have that sort of policy or even expect to be held liable for personal relationships that occurred between students and or former students and teachers, I think really stretches the scope of foreseeability that the court has applied in Doe 59 or in Doe 175 and the other cases.
Well, but we have a former student who is more than a former student. We have a volunteer. Are you saying the school district takes no supervisory, has no duty to volunteers who are still, in fact, students and under the age of majority?
So I don't think there's any case law that says that a school has a specific responsibility for minors that are not its students. This student came in a volunteer capacity just like a parent would come in and volunteer in a classroom. So to the extent that the school has, you know, sort of ordinary liability for things like slip and falls or, you know, a safe environment in the building, I think that those obligations existed. But there isn't a special duty to protect minors who are not enrolled in the school, or at least there's not one that a court has ever found.
What about, if I may, is there any policy in the record dealing with classroom teachers' responsibilities to protect their students from guests in the classroom, or anything dealing with guests in the classroom? So let's look at this a little broader.
And I know I'm out of time.
No, you may answer. Thank you.
There is a policy that I believe is in this record about visitors to the school building that contains requirements such as visitors must sign in before going to a classroom, and that they, you know, need to have a visitor badge on to be identifiable to staff. But in this record, the student says he always did sign in, but the volunteer policy isn't intended to protect volunteers. It's intended to protect the students and the other people in the building.
If I may, one follow-up question, Judge Miller. Does it place any responsibility on the classroom teacher as far as the policies dealing with visitors to the school?
So it doesn't specifically say here is the classroom teacher's responsibility. I think the teachers have a responsibility, you know, if you see somebody wandering around in the building without a visitor badge, to report that to the office, but it doesn't say this teacher has to keep this classroom safe. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bright, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I think where we get hung up on the government immunity issue, as argued by the school, by the respondent, is this lawfully assigned argument, that it's lawfully assigned. And so, you know, it involves other times governments are liable because somebody did something that was part of their job. Here it's sexual abuse. So you start off with it's an unlawful act. And so what they basically argue is, well, since it's an unlawful act, it wasn't lawfully assigned because we didn't tell him to sexually abuse the kid.
Mr. Brandt, can I just probe one issue that we didn't talk about in your initial argument, but was raised by the respondent, and that is whether, I mean, grooming is a horrible, awful series of events that leads to assaultive behavior. But I'm struggling because I don't find any Minnesota law that recognizes the act of grooming as an independent tort other than the assaultive act.
Sure.
And what we're dealing with, I think, right now is things that happened in on school property that may constitute grooming. If it's not an independent tort, how do we even... I mean, I wonder if we even get to the issue of immunity if we're not even dealing with a tort.
Sure. Our argument is it's a part of what ends up creating the actual tort, which is the sexual abuse, which is the unlawful act.
And what's the authority that this is all one thing, and from the beginning of the grooming until the end of the assault, that is one wrongful act, as opposed to grooming being one wrongful act and the assault being a different wrongful act?
They're connected. The argument would be because the connection between the two, that it's a result. He can arguably groom 100 people, okay, and only sexually abuse one of them. And it would only be the one that would have the case, I guess, as the law sits right now.
All right.
But what the key is the grooming is what he's able to do lawfully as a teacher. He's able to take his authority and take that position of kids in his possession, kids that they're supposed to be taking care of, whether they're volunteer kids, they're still all minor kids. And being able to take advantage of that position to eventually sexually abuse these children.
If I could just frame it a little bit differently, your argument or your claim is that the entirety of the act begins with the grooming and ends with the assault. There's no tort absent the assault because that's the damage. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
I understand.
Yeah. I don't think we don't have a recognized just grooming tort the 99 people could come in here and bring a claim. You need to have the horrible result that takes place from the grooming. But the grooming is all taking place under that authority, which gets us to that point.
And just to distinguish it from other torts, like with a car accident, it happens at one point in time. Like, that is the wrongful act. So we're dealing with a negligent or an intentional tort, negligence or an intentional tort that occurs over a period of time. That's the argument that you're making.
Without being too plain of creative, I will just say yes to that. I could probably come up with other
good answer.
I will just say yes.
Thank you. I understand.
There. So I think that gets us to where this question goes, that it's based upon what did they see, what should have they seen, how they could have seen it, and is there enough there so a jury gets to hear that? A jury may listen to all this and decide, you know, we think it's too distant, or they wouldn't have known, or they were doing the best they could. But is there enough there to get over that hurdle? And I go back to my start on this, is I think the court was struggling with the idea of, is it 2 red flags? Is it 15 red flags? Is it how many red flags it is? And I think one is enough, but there are enough here that we should have been allowed to go forward and be able to present our case to a jury. That's the key there. Any other questions? That I think got us to the point. So any other questions? You guys don't have here. So thank you very much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. We really appreciate it. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.